We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. At the controls this morning, Kyle Mabry. Harriet Williamson is our producer. In late May of this year, one of the world's most wanted men, former Serbian General Ratko Mladic, was arrested and sent to The Hague to stand trial for war crimes. Mladic, who'd been in hiding for more than 15 years, is charged with genocide in connection with the killing of 8,000 Muslim men and boys in the town of Srebrenica. He's also charged in relation to the siege of the city of Sarajevo. This morning in this part of the show, we'll be looking back to the Balkan Wars of the 1990s and also try to talk a little bit about the changes that have occurred in the region since. And our guest for the program is John Menzies. He served as chief of mission at the U.S. office in Kosovo, also served as the U.S. ambassador to Bosnia-Herzegovina for most of 1996. In addition, he participated in the Dayton peace talks and worked to oversee U.S. post-war assistance there. He's also served in the U.S. Foreign Service in Hungary, East Germany, and Bulgaria. Today, he is dean of the Whitehead School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University, and he's joining us by phone. Questions are welcome. We hope people will be brief and will be on target with our topic, but questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us if it would be a long-distance call. That's 800-222-9455. Also, we have email. If you'd like to send along a thought that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. That's the address to use. And Ambassador Menzies, hello.
Hello. How are you, Dave?
I am fine. Thank you. And how are you?
Doing well.
Good. I thank you very much for spending some time to talk with us today.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you.
The place to start, I think, probably is the most recent bit of news here, and that is the arrest of General Mladic. He served as the commander of the Bosnian Serb army during the Balkan Wars, and as I said, was one of the most wanted men in the world, and probably is one of the last major figures from that time that was still at large. Talk a little bit about just how significant his arrest is.
Well, it's a major step forward. He has been hunted now for about 15 years. Think of it in terms of about the same time that it took to track down Eichmann after the Second World War. So it's been a very long time. The geography was a lot more simple. But I've been told that the Serbs have been hunting him seriously for the last couple of years, and that's good news. His capture lifts one of the last remaining burdens of guilt from the people of Serbia, because he can now answer for the crimes which he committed, and that's a very good thing. There's only one more criminal that's wanted by the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, and that's Goran Hadžić, who is responsible for crimes in Croatia.
We can talk, and certainly should, just remind people of the charges against General Mladic. But before that, I know that for a long time now, there have been people in the international community who believed that, or thought it very likely, that the Serbian government knew where General Mladic was. And if the government had wanted to, it could have taken him into custody, and that they just weren't. And that the only reason that this has happened now is that the Serbian government is interested in joining the European Union. And that was one of the conditions that was clearly stated, that they should arrest General Mladic and send him on to The Hague. And I guess I wonder, first of all, what you think about this major kind of charge that the Serbian government knew where he was and was turning a blind eye.
I think there's probably some truth to that. I think we went through three different iterations. The first was where there was probably active complicity in hiding him in some quarters of the Serb authorities. The second was where they simply ignored him after the pressure was on and simply failed to arrest, even though they may have known where he was. The third was where they were actively pursuing him and with the intent to arrest and move forward. Certainly the European Union conditionality was a major stimulus. But let me just say that his arrest should not be the fast track to the European Union. This should not mean instant membership. There are other things that Serbia must do.
And there certainly, it seems clear that there, in fact, are other things on this list, and this was just one of them. But perhaps the Serbian government felt that they needed to get that one crossed off, particularly as it was my understanding that that they were just they were days away from the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague issuing a report essentially saying that Serbia had not been cooperating in this effort to find General Mladic. So for the Serbian government, I imagine that's probably good that they can cross that one off the list.
It's very good news. And I must say that we have to give credit where it is due. They arrested him. They delivered him. Mm-hmm. And the credit is due to the government of the Serbs right now for their actions in this matter. Again, it's not sufficient to give them a fast track to Europe, in my view, but it was certainly a welcome development, and they should be praised for having arrested him and done the right thing, finally.
I think shortly after the arrest, there was some question as to whether or not this would cause problems for the current Serbian government and the current Serbian president, Boris Tadic, and it seems not to have.
No, the reaction was relatively muted. Certainly there were some hardcore followers that did make some noise, but it was not what people had expected. In part, I think the people of Serbia have finally begun to come to terms with the crimes that were committed in their name and on their behalf. In fact, it's to be observed that as documentaries have begun to appear on Serbian TV about what happened, there has been a wave of revulsion for the actions that were committed by some people, but the people of Serbia have claimed, I think quite rightly, that this was not done in their name and not for them. But it's certainly not something they would have approved of.
One thing that struck me, and in this, it's possible that this is now dated, because as you say, I think as people see more of the evidence for what happened, they become increasingly unhappy. But that there was a poll taken right after the arrest that found, on the one hand, 51% of Serbs said they thought General Mladic was a hero, but at the same time, 45% said the arrest was in Serbia's national interest, which would suggest that maybe the approach they're taking is pragmatic here, and that their head says one thing but their heart says something else.
Right, but sometimes the heart follows the head over time. That's how we overcome huge social problems, prejudices, and that kind of thing. So I think this is a positive poll. If you'd taken the same poll 5 years ago, not to mention 10 or 15 years ago, the numbers would have been radically different.
Just quickly to introduce the guest this morning, we're speaking with Ambassador John Menzies. He is Dean of the Whitehead School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University, and also has many years' experience working in the U.S. Foreign Service. He served as Chief of Mission of the U.S. Office in Kosovo, and he also served as the U.S. Ambassador to Bosnia-Herzegovina for most of the year of 1996. He was also involved in the Dayton peace talks, and we are talking about recent events in the Balkans, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. There are, I'm sure, some people will be well aware of the story of Srebrenica, but for those who are not, just give us briefly what happened there, and what are the allegations that are being made against General Mladic?
Well, there were a number of areas that were named safe areas by the United Nations where the local populace was supposedly going to be safe from the threat of war and the domination of the other party. And the Srebrenica was one, Djepa was another, Garajda another, and one was overrun very early in all of this, a little town called Cherska. And in July of 1995, I was nominally in Bosnia at that period, but I was back for consultations when this happened and returned early. In July of 1995, Serb forces overran the enclave at Srebrenica, the safe area protected by UN forces, supposedly. And there they forced the people to leave. They committed crimes of many, a wide variety of crimes, but the worst crime was that they murdered 8,000 Muslim men and boys. Mm-hmm. It's the worst atrocity in Europe since World War II. And they deported everybody. They met, I think, a lot of the definitions of genocide very, very perfectly, their actions there. And so that's what happened. Mm-hmm.
And I'm certain that General Mladic and those people who will represent him at The Hague will argue that he was not responsible, that he did not direct this. Is it your feeling that the evidence is strong that shows, in fact, that he was in command while this happened?
Well, I think there's no dispute as to who was in command, and the chain of command argument has been already established already by the tribunal. So I think he's going to have a difficult time with his defense. I have confidence that the tribunal will do everything according to the rule of law and will give him every opportunity to defend himself and will be very fair and even-handed in their proceedings. But I think it's going to be a difficult case for him to make that he wasn't involved. He's filmed on the spot.
It looks like we have a caller who is ready to talk with us. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller here is on our line number one in Thomasboro. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, Ambassador, one of the questions I have, you know, as a consequence of everything that the United States and the UN went in there with military forces, and one of the weapons the United States used was uranium munitions, which are illegal under all things, the United Nations and everything, Geneva Convention. As a consequence, in 94 and 95, we used about 30 tons, and in 99 again, and 2000, we used about 40 tons. The United Nations, Pekka Haavisto, had directed that it all be cleaned up. The Army regulations, United States Department of Defense Army regulations, were required that it's all cleaned up and medical care being provided to everybody. Unfortunately, to this day, it is still not being done. I was just wondering if you have some thoughts on how we can get the United States and NATO to comply with their own requirements, and how do we deal with the health effects from that?
Well, I think this is something that would have to be taken up with NATO in Brussels, and there are clear lines of communication and authority there. I remember it was stated at the time that this was going on, but I'm really not familiar with any efforts to clean it up at this point, and don't know where things stand exactly. So I wish I could be of more help, but I think that NATO's the right address to approach.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, both NATO and the United States Department of Defense have just simply refused to comply with the directive. So, anyhow, it's an environmental health problem. Just not only that, but a lot of stuff throughout the Balkans. It's seriously affecting everybody that we need to take in consideration.
I understand that, just as the landmines are another problem that has to be tackled, is being tackled, but it goes slowly.
All right, I thank the caller. We'll go on to Effingham for another. Line number four. Hello.
Yes. First, a question. What we're discussing, or you're discussing today, is what had been Yugoslavia.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Then it began to disintegrate after the Soviet Union began to deteriorate. And then all the ethnic things that evolved out of that, now we're seeing in Eastern Asia and Western Asia and in North Africa. How long is this going to go on? I mean, there's the chaos, the human sacrifices and all that been going on from the time that the old Soviet Union fell. And if you could articulate a little about what Yugoslavia was, how it came into being, and such, I think that's pertinent to the conversation. Thank you very much. Bye.
Well, I can comment somewhat on the history. It really emerged after the First World War as the state that it was for the interwar period and surviving into the present in part. Serbia was one of the first battlegrounds in the First World War. The Austrians took a great drubbing there, but it was really after the First World War that it expanded. It gained parts of Hungary and other areas, and different geographic additions were made and redrawings of the map. So all of that took place. The breakup of Yugoslavia was based, I think, on the aspirations of the peoples in the various regions. And it hasn't sort of reverted to type. There are parts of Yugoslavia that were ceded from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, for example, from the Hungarian side, from the Austrian side, and those have part has remained with Yugoslavia, part has not. So there have been different outcomes and adjustments ever since Yugoslavia was created in the form that we knew it. And the breakup, as I say, was related to the aspirations of different groups of people in the region. We found that in the former Soviet Union as well. Personally, I view this as a tremendously hopeful sign for the world that you can actually get over things and you can actually heal politically and socially. It gives me great hope to see what's going on across the Middle East, because we're seeing what I think Christiane Amanpour has called a primal scream for freedom and against injustice there. And I think this is a very good sign, a hopeful sign for the world, making this possibly the most hopeful time in history, because I think we'll see good things evolve from this, as just indeed as we're seeing in parts of Yugoslavia, where people are beginning to get over the wounds. It's going to take a long time, but we'll see new arrangements arise, new social compacts between the government and the governed, things that were not possible before.
Well, you know, I do think that the caller does make a useful point in pointing us back to the end of the Cold War and what that meant for the former Yugoslavia, in the sense that, and this is something that we talked about quite a lot back during that time when the conflict was actually going on,
yes,
that you would hear over and over again people, their way of dismissing this was the ancient ethnic hatreds argument. They said, oh, you know, these people, they have these old grudges and they go back hundreds of years and they've always been fighting and so they're always going to fight and this is just sort of natural. And what that seemed to deny was the fact that, at least in, there are a lot of places in Yugoslavia that people managed to get along pretty well, but in the period after the fall of the Soviet Union, there were people in the region and certainly people in the governments of the region, particularly in Croatia and Serbia, who had ambitions, who were interested in being independent. On the one side, the Croatians were drawn toward Europe. The Serbians were still drawn toward Russia. They were interested in accumulating power. They were interested in accumulating land. And so that pretty much explains what happened, and it doesn't really have that much to do with ancient ethnic hatred as it was a spectacular kind of land grab that was touched off by the fact that the Soviet influence holding everything together there was gone.
Well, David, you're absolutely right about the ancient hatreds. If you look at Sarajevo, Bosnia-Herzegovina was actually a safe haven for the Jews being expelled from the Iberian Peninsula 500 years ago. And people in Sarajevo enjoyed each other's religions, their religious holidays, I should say, their festivals. They celebrated together. The rate of intermarriage was very high. And people actually got along perfectly well. What happened after, with the fall of communism, was that a lot of negative passions were also unleashed. They began, oddly enough, what you could argue with some ultra sort of hyper nationalist thinking going on at the Academy of Sciences in Belgrade. All of this was picked up by Milosevic and used as a political football. And when it became clear that the government could no longer exercise absolute authority over the entire territory, of course, I would say not hatreds, but aspirations came to the fore. People wanted to be free. They wanted to be free of a system of government that was communist-based and had carried over a lot of the bad habits of communism. And so I look at the breakup as having been a terribly positive thing initially, but it was when the military and the violent reaction followed that it became so devastating to the peoples of the region.
Hmm. Well, I wonder, just looking back, you know, I think that one of the things that I certainly recall from the time is that there were a lot of complaints by Serbians who felt that too much attention was directed to what they had done, and their argument was, well, they tried to deflect that again, I think, by saying, well, other people were doing the same things. And certainly there were questions about what the policies of the Croatian government of the time, led by a man named Franjo Tuđman, who is now, like Slobodan Milosevic, both of them are gone now. They're both passed. But, you know, the Serbs certainly complained about the treatment of ethnic Serbs in this territory that that was in Croatia and was next to Serbia. And they complained long and hard about, well, it's not fair here. Everybody's criticizing us, but nobody's really paying attention to what has happened to Serbs in the Krajina, this region of Croatia. And perhaps one could say that the same thing about other places within Yugoslavia. And I guess I just wonder what you think about that, and whether you think not that an inappropriate amount of attention was devoted to Serbia, but that not enough attention was devoted to what was going on other places.
I think if I were part of that time and that place, I would make the same argument. But the truth is very different from that interpretation. Most of the crimes were committed without doubt. Preponderance of crimes, against humanity, crimes of genocide, were committed by one party and not by all three equally. And so I'm not trying to excuse any crimes of genocide or the crimes of murder, crimes against humanity. I don't excuse those at all. But the preponderance of them were attributable to Serb forces, irregulars and regulars, that were involved in the fighting in different places. In war, there is a great deal of violence that's involved, but in this case, we can assign the preponderance of it to one side. And I think, you know, Srebrenica is just the tip of the iceberg there. There are other places that some have been in the news recently where terrible things took place and people are remembering still.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that were there wrongs? Certainly there were wrongs. But democracy provides a way for you to deal with the wrongs and move on, and to address inequities and where you can provide the protection of law for individuals and not just groups. That's really very important, and that's what was not going on in the period running up to the Wars of Independence, if you want to call them that.
Hmm. Well, a fair amount of time now has passed since the wars that we're talking about. This was the early to mid-90s.
Yes.
And you talked a little bit earlier about healing having taken place. Do you think that is in fact the case, that some, at least, healing has taken place?
Some has taken place, but there are still problems, and this is why we have to come back to the role of Serbia and what they still need to do before they can become part of the European Union. They need to play a far more constructive role in Kosovo in particular,
mm-hmm.
Where Serbs are now in the minority and there is great pressure on the Kosovars to deal equitably with all citizens, regardless of background or ethnic origin or religion, all of those things. But the government in Belgrade needs to play a very constructive role and not interfere negatively. For example, there are still efforts to partition Kosovo. There are suggestions the Serbs should move from where they lived in the south and move to the north. That's a form of ethnic cleansing as well, insist that Serbs, and this is Belgrade that has in the past been doing this, encouraging them to find places to live in the north and sort of create a ground truth of a Serb enclave in the north. And they should be more constructive. They should be helping Serbs stay where they are, making their lives better, conducting trade by providing more moral support by dealing with the government of Kosovo and working with them to create and assure that the rule of law applies to everybody equally. In Bosnia, they need to be more constructive in their dealings with the Republika Srpska. They should not be providing, and I think to a large degree they're moving in that direction, they're not providing the sort of solace to the recidivist forces that still want to partition Bosnia and create an absolutely independent Serb republic or one that will unite with Serbia, that kind of thing. And there they've been making good progress, but they still need to exert a positive influence on events in Bosnia where they can. And I think they're doing pretty well there, less well in Kosovo.
Well, we'll come back to Kosovo, but I wonder more about the general point. It says that before the wars, these were societies that were much more integrated and multicultural, and that as a result of war fighting, ethnic cleansing, forcing people to move, that what has actually happened is that their people tend to be much more divided ethnically than they were before. Is that true?
Absolutely. But as I say, I think the inertia of human systems is to heal. And if we would let them heal, help them heal, they will. But trying to create a separate Serb republic in Kosovo of some kind or to secede from Kosovo or secede from Bosnia doesn't help the healing process. It's counterindicated.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it more difficult for the healing to go forward. So that's why we would ask the Serbs to play a more constructive role. And again, I think they're trying to do this in Bosnia with the Republika Srpska. They need to be more pronounced there, but they need to do a lot more, it seems to me, for the Serbs and on their behalf in Kosovo without trying to dictate the outcome of the social redevelopment there.
In this part of Focus, we are talking with John Menzies. He is dean of the Whitehead School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University. Also has served in the U.S. Foreign Service in Bosnia back in 1996. We'll talk some more with him after a short break. This is Focus.
British comedian Steve Coogan is a man of many voices.
I'd like a vodka martini, shaken but not stirred.
He and comic Rob Brydon trade barbs and impersonations in the new road film, The Trip. On the next Fresh Air, Steve Coogan and Las Vegas pawn shop owner Rick Harrison of the History Channel's Pawn Stars. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is Charles Fishman. He's a journalist, award-winning business writer. We'll be talking about his book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Then tomorrow in the second hour, we'll have another installment of a project we're calling The Deep Archives. And we're doing this to mark our 30th anniversary. The show has been on the air 30 years. And we have gone into our tape collection to pull out some interviews that have not been heard in a long time. These are interviews from one from 1994 and the other from 99 that you'll hear tomorrow, parts of these interviews. The first with anthropologist Mary Catherine Bateson. talking about learning and what that's all about, how schools are structured, the need for learning all through life. Then in the second hour, Theodore Roszak, who is known for writing about the counterculture of the 60s, this is an interview that we did with him in 1999 about a book that he'd written that looks at the growing up of the baby boom generation and what it will mean that those people, some of them who were involved in the counterculture of the 60s, are now seniors and in later on in life, and how it is they're thinking about what they should be doing at that time of life. I think they're interesting. I hope you will find them so. That's tomorrow morning in our 11 o'clock hour. You can look at our schedule and listen to past programs by going to our website. It's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of focus, our guest is Ambassador John Menzies. He's Dean of the Whitehead School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University. Has served in the Foreign Service, has held posts in Hungary, East Germany, Bulgaria, and also the former Yugoslavia. He was chief of mission at the U.S. office in Kosovo. He also served as the U.S. ambassador to Bosnia-Herzegovina for most of the year of 1996. Also participated in the Dayton peace talks, was involved in post-war assistance to the region. Questions here are welcome as we're trying to talk about what has happened recently there. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps it just we could talk a little bit more about Kosovo. It's been a while since it was so much in the news, but people perhaps will recall this is it's a part of Serbia that most of the population is ethnically Albanian, and there was a very strong independence movement there. The Serbs also were equally strong about wanting it to remain part of Serbia. A little over 3 years ago, Kosovo declared independence from Serbia, but that still has not been recognized by a lot of governments around the world. And so there's still some, certainly the Serbians didn't recognize it. I think some people make the argument that that's, again, it's another one of these things that if Serbia is really going to come in from the cold and be part of Europe, it's got to be resolved. Where exactly does the status of Kosovo stand now?
I'm not sure of the exact number of nations that have recognized Kosovo, but it's a very significant number now, including the U.S. Of course, we recognize it as an independent state and respect its sovereignty and call on other nations to do so as well. Most of the European Union has recognized it, but some key holdouts remain. The progress in Kosovo, I think, has been very good, and I think that there is great hope for the future there, for the rule of law, and for the future of different ethnic minorities and ethnic groups to live together.
Well, I know that people have raised questions about the viability of Kosovo as an independent state. Certainly, the Kosovar Albanians have had this for some time, had this strong drive for independence, I suppose some people would think, well, it would be probably natural for it to somehow be affiliated with Albania, right, which it adjoins. What potential do you think it has, though, for being an independent state, and does it really still have to be somehow strongly attached to either Albania or to Serbia?
Well, let's take a look for a moment at its history. As you rightly pointed out, it's more than 90% ethnic Albanian. Now, you have to remember that the ethnic Albanians were excluded from the social mainstream, and jobs were taken away in the 80s. They were excluded from schools. They were excluded from the social safety net, from the health system. And what happened in response was that they created their own shadow government and what was essentially the world's largest non-governmental organization, the largest NGO. They provided their own schools with lunches. They provided their own system of health. They created a parallel parliament an opposition parliament. They elected a president. They created a taxation system worldwide where ethnic Albanians taxed themselves, I believe, at the rate of 3% a year voluntarily to support this largest NGO in the world. And so do they have the capability to create a nation? You bet they do. Can they make it work? Of course they can. It's a small country, but with an incredible entrepreneurial spirit, with a desire to succeed and an absolute determination to make a go of it. So they will succeed. There are smaller nations in the world than Kosovo that have existed for hundreds and hundreds of years. And Kosovo will make it as a nation. I have every reason to believe that. Having lived and worked with them, I think they're on the right track, and there's room in Kosovo for Serbs, for Roma, for other minority groups, and there's room for people to do business and to live with the security of law to protect them.
Mm-hmm. We started out talking about the arrest of the Serbian army commander Ratko Mladic and the fact that he was, for a long time, at least when it came to the former Yugoslavia and the conflict here in the Balkans, there were a list of people that had been indicted and that were wanted for war crimes. And he was one of the people that had been on that list for a very long time. There was also somebody else who had been on that list for quite a long time. And this was the man who had been the political leader of the Bosnian Serbs, a man named Radovan Karadzic, who also had been somebody who had been in hiding for a long time. Was finally captured, and he is in The Hague and there's been an ongoing trial that he's been involved. And he's also been charged in connection with some of the same crimes General Mladic has been charged with, that is the Srebrenica massacre and the siege of Sarajevo. Is that something that you've been following?
Yes, I've been following it. I actually arrived in Sarajevo during the siege. I arrived in late 1994, ostensibly for a 30-day temporary duty, and I ended up staying for almost 2.5 years and going through a whole range of job titles, from acting deputy chief of mission to deputy chief of mission, acting chief of mission to chief of mission, to ambassador designate to ambassador. And so I was there a lot longer than anyone had envisioned. So I went through the siege, and I actually met Karadzic 4 times, I believe, before he was indicted. After he was indicted, I couldn't meet with him. I did send him a letter calling for him to surrender himself and go to The Hague. But I actually have met him, on 4 occasions.
Mm. What were your impressions of him? What sort of person is he?
Well, I'd hate to characterize him. I was trying to find things that I could identify as potential common bonds, and I really had a difficult time.
Mm.
He's not someone that I found that I could warm to.
Mm. Well, in talking about you and your career and your service in the former Yugoslavia, I'm trying to be as brief as I possibly can. I know I did not fully list all the things that you've done, but we really wanted to talk to you because you had so much experience there in that region. And so, and given that, let me ask you about because we really haven't talked very much about the siege of Sarajevo, this thing that went on for a number of years. And again, both of these men, Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic, are charged with crimes in connection with that event too. So you were there. What was it like? What happened there over those years?
Well, it was uneven. Coming in and into Sarajevo and leaving Sarajevo was always shaky. Sometimes you'd drive past cars that were on fire on off the road. And one night we came in under a barrage. One morning we had to wait outside the airport, which was held by the UN, but the French were in charge, and they only opened at a certain time. So we sat outside the berm until mortar rounds started landing near us, and then they brought us inside. So that was interesting, but every evening there'd be a lot of shooting. One night there was so much shooting outside of our embassy when we were at the Holiday Inn. We started it with our offices at the Holiday Inn in Sniper's Alley, which is still there. And while we were having a building a little further away from the actual conflict that was being renovated, and the shooting was terrible, and we had a satellite dish that was sort of handheld that we pushed outside a window, and I said to the guards, "Let's just pull this in." So we pulled it in, and within 20 minutes, the first time the building had been hit by a rocket in years, missed us by about 30 feet. And I always think that a lazy artilleryman goes by landmarks rather than coordinates, and they missed us as we blacked out the windows. So it was interesting living in under a siege, and every day was exciting. We drove around in the limo with the flags, the State Department flag and the U.S. flag on the limo every day, so that people would see us in the city and know we were there.
And this is now, we talked earlier about Srebrenica and that this estimate that in that one relatively short-term event, 8,000, we think maybe 8,000 people died.
Yeah.
Here we're talking about something that stretched over a period of years, but in this particular case, the estimate of people likely dead is more like, is even more. It's like 10,000 people were thought 10, to have died.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the actual worst single event, shelling event, was in Tuzla, where on graduation day, as I understand it, after the kids had graduated, they fired two heavy rounds of artillery shells into the downtown area and killed about 150 young people outright and maimed dozens and dozens more.
Mm. What was it, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that before these wars started, there were certainly places where people of different religious ethnic backgrounds seemed to be able to live with one another pretty well, and I think a lot of people would say Sarajevo actually was one of those places, that it was a multi-ethnic community where people managed to live quite successfully. What was it that made Sarajevo a target?
I really don't know what made it the target. Maybe it was the very fact that it was such a cosmopolitan and urbane city, you know, that was a center of culture, of art, of thought, of innovation. And so it would be the place in Bosnia-Herzegovina that you'd want to bring down because it was the most diverse city. And by the way, it retained part of that character throughout the war. They even had a group of 99 of their artists and thinkers and cultural leaders who met together all through the war, even. So it retained something of that diversity and the eclectic and cosmopolitan view of the world that it had had throughout its history.
Mm-hmm.
But only there's just so much you can do when the guns are firing over your head, when you have to dodge snipers' bullets and that kind of thing.
That's so. I think, though, that seems to be one of the remarkable aspects of this whole story. And a lot of people have, a lot of books have been written about it. People who are journalists have written about it, and people who live there have written about it. The thing I'm thinking of is the remarkable commitment of so many people to stay, to try to live as best they could, given that here over a period of years it was a place that was under attack and you could be standing in line, you know, somewhere to buy food and you could find yourself a target, or just walking down the street you could find yourself a target. And it seems, again, remarkable that there were people who decided that they were going, maybe there were some people who couldn't leave, but there were also people who actually decided that they were going to stay, that they weren't going to be driven out.
This was a fairly general sentiment. That's why men showed up to work in suits and ties all through the war in some places, and not everybody, but a lot did. It's why people dressed up to go to coffee houses and restaurants, and they weren't going to be corrupted by the presence of the guns, and they weren't going to let other people make them do something else. I remember seeing on the news interviews of people that were actually being driven from their houses, and their houses were being burned behind them. And one of the women that was fleeing looked at the camera and said, "And still we do not hate them. They can't make us hate them."
Mm.
And that sense of hope and determination to rise above it is something that characterizes the people of Sarajevo and was one of the outstanding sentiments of the time.
It sounds, I can hear the emotion in your voice as you talk about this, that it sounds like it's something that even all these years later still moves you when you talk about it.
It all still resonates. I remember, you know, the good and bad of it all. But the baseline is I'm still very hopeful for Sarajevo, for the entire region. It's going to make it.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus again is John Menzies. He is a former ambassador from the United States. He served as U.S. Chief of Mission in Kosovo and a number of posts. As he explained, he spent a lot of time in the city of Kosovo when, in the city of Sarajevo when the siege was going on there. He also served as ambassador to Bosnia-Herzegovina for the year of 1996, was involved in the Dayton peace talks. He is now the dean of the Whitehead School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University. And certainly questions, comments are welcome. We'll be here for about another 5 minutes. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We do have that email possibility as well. If you decide you'd like to participate that way, you certainly can. The address is will-talk, but you got to put the hyphen in there, at illinois.edu. So at any point here, you can give us a call. I guess I find myself, again, very struck by the fact that you, knowing how difficult diplomacy is and having lived through a lot of this and having seen it firsthand, that you can be as optimistic as you seem to be about the future of this region. And now, you know, it has been a number of years, and yet it's not that long. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who remember what was going on there at that time, and particularly for us here in the United States, trying to understand what exactly was going on and what this was all about. I guess I think it's remarkable and encouraging that you can be as positive about the future of this region as you are.
I remember giving a talk at a college in Virginia back in 1988, saying that none of the governments of Eastern Europe would be in place in 7 years. Boy, was I off! I got a lot of laughs, but it was less than a year, and they were all gone. We have every reason to believe that the world is mutable. It can change, and it can be improved. I am concerned about Bosnia because there are still recidivist elements there on all sides that would like to prolong the struggle for separation and create independent countries, at least two of them. And there are things that we need to do to still lead the way to make sure that doesn't happen, that the sacrifice of thousands of man-years in terms of people that we sent to the region, our soldiers, our diplomats, the people in the NGO world, we sacrificed blood and treasure, billions of dollars, and we can't let that influence, that investment, be done away with by the few who are seeking to achieve in peace what they couldn't by war. And I hope that we can do that, that we not lose our focus on Bosnia right now.
Well, does the current Serb government have some kind of leverage there as far as the attitudes and of the Bosnian Serbs go?
You mean Tadic?
Yes,
they can be very constructive. And again, I give them credit where it's due. I appreciate a lot of their efforts to rein in these sentiments in Bosnia. They need to do more. But we welcome everything they do to try to make Bosnia a success and not create an even greater failure out in the region. It's the crowd in Banja Luka that we really have to worry about that still want to achieve their war aims in peace. And we need to apply more pressure, not lose focus, not see them move too quickly or any of the region move too quickly toward the European Union, because once they're in the European Union, nothing ever changes afterwards or has to change.
Yeah. But just to make sure people know, Banja Luka, that's the capital of the Serb Republic,
Correct.
Srpska.
Yes.
So as we said, the Serbs are interested in getting closer to Europe, becoming EU members, and that there were a number of things that that people in Europe wanted the Serbs to address. War crimes, one issue. Future of Kosovo, perhaps another issue. Question of Bosnia, perhaps another issue. And I think you have said that your interest, that you want to make sure that these things do get resolved. But the long, you see long term, the potential for Serbia to really become part of Europe, whether that really, you know, at what point that formally they become a member of the EU, maybe not so much an issue as actually moving into a closer affiliation with Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. But I see the same future for Kosovo and for Bosnia, but only with some help from Serbia in the run up to that. And this should be part of the conditionality for Serbia moving forward, that they play an ever more constructive role in the region and give up some of the rhetoric which has been popular, move forward with courage and with vision so that they can improve the life of all the people of the region, especially the Serbs that they're concerned about. A lot of their policies have actually harmed the Serbs.
Well, I think that we're at the point where we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have a caller we can't take. We're just at the end of our time. Our guest, John Menzies, is Dean of the Whitehead School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University. Also served in the Foreign Service, had a lot of experience in the former Yugoslavia. And Ambassador Menzies, thank you very much for talking with us today.
David, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.